broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Our guest today is Mr. Ted Rowe. Ted is co-founder and executive director of the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, or NARCAP. Which was established in 1999 with the focus on UAP and aviation safety. He was born and raised in Great Falls, Montana during the 1960s and 70s. And his interest in UAP and UAP research arose from local events and direct personal experience. Alongside his work with Dr. Richard Haynes and the team at NARCAP, he has established and administrates the International Association of UAP Researchers. Currently, he resides on the Big Island, Hawaii, where he teaches free diving, martial arts, and Zen meditation, in addition to his duties administrating NARCAP. And we're privileged to have him with us today. Welcome to the show, Ted.
Hi, David. Kind of an interesting background there. I didn't really expect you to draw from that far back. I run NARCAP, have run it for since its inception in 1999 with Dr. Haynes. Mm-hmm. In 2021, I was invited to help set up a program at the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics focused on aviation safety and UAP. And we're in our coming up on the end of our second year with that. And then a year ago, I set up the UAP Medical Coalition, which is intended to inform medical and mental health professionals about UAP and UAP exposures and to encourage research and improve patient care. So
okay,
I have several programs I'm running at the moment.
So is that... I was going to ask you to tell our listeners about NARCAP and its mission. Is that its mission?
Sure. Well, to improve aviation safety and enhance scientific knowledge was our general purpose. We advocate for civil aviation, commercial and private pilots, to allow them to report. The FAA doesn't allow UFO reports from pilots. So
NARCAP, NARCAP, MUFON, they have to take care of it, right?
Yeah, that's what we've done for many years. And now that the government has a program together, they've instructed the FAA to modify their reporting requirements. We wrote a paper at AIAA recommending what ought to be done and how it should be done. And that was, as it turns out, the NASA UAP independent study team acknowledged that probably was the right path. And so it looks like those recommendations are going forward.
Okay.
So that's really kind of the culmination of what NARCAP set out to do, which was to change the reporting regimen so that aviation safety planners could see whether what kind of issues arise from UAP encounters. We had over 100 years of pilot reports, and many of them reflect safety factors. So that was kind of our primary mission. And then when the government finally admitted that UAP exists and that they're a national security threat and that they are a hazard to aviation safety, the AIAA set up a safety program. And I was one of the co-founders of that project. So
what is that?
AIAA, is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It's the premier aeronautical sciences and engineering professional society in the world. We have about 70 some technical teams that are available to us that cover every aspect of flight and air traffic management and so on. And our mandate right now is to develop some detection modalities so that we can tell when UAP are around.
Mm-hmm.
So
they say you have a hundred years of pilot reports. I didn't think the pilots were able to or supposed to report these things.
Well, these are newspaper clippings. These are anecdotal reports that go back to 1916
mm-hmm.
And span the entire history of powered flight. Some of them became reports for the military or for Project Blue Book or, you know, other branches of the military or U.S. government. Others didn't. Others weren't reported that way. They went to newspapers or they went to reporting systems like ours. Several thousands of them, 1,300 of them in one catalog that we have from 1916 till 2000. We documented about 3,400 cases. And I've had many more come at me since.
Mm-hmm.
Pilots have been loath to talk about these things. So what we hear about is not the overall picture by any stretch.
Oh, no. But do you find that there are more reports? They're more, they feel better, they feel more at ease to report these things now that the Pentagon has admitted their existence?
I think that's influencing the number of reports we get. A lot of it's historical. There's not a lot you can do with it. There's only 2-week window after an incident occurs to get data, to either get a hard copy of the audio or to get a radar hard copy that you mm-hmm. can reconstruct. So if you don't get that request out within 2 weeks of it happening, you won't get any peripheral data.
Why is that?
It's just the FAA records an awful lot. All of its operations are recorded, and they only have limited space and limited access, so they turn it over every 2 weeks and start recording again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the way they handle digital data or data right now. Part of our paper was about data management, in the context of UAP reports, but we advised that reports should go to the Aviation Safety Reporting System
mm-hmm.
and that there's a strong chain of custody there and a transparent bin that the public can look in and look at the cases. So that was our advisement in that direction.
Now, I understand that you and or NARCAP joined the, or rather coined the term UAP as opposed to UFO in the U.S. as a more accurate description of things seen in the sky. Is that correct?
Yes, we did. I mean, the term, you know, the adjective phrase unidentified aerial phenomena has been around and it's been used, but mm-hmm. but the actual proper noun with a description Dr. Haynes came out with that 1980 or so, and then we adopted it with our first paper in 1999.
Okay. So it's been around a while.
Yeah, yeah. And then it went viral eventually. Now everybody uses it. Nobody knows where it came from. It has the same cachet as UFO, and it's becoming useless as a term. It's like trying to describe Hawaii by saying it doesn't look like Nebraska.
Are you in Hawaii right now?
No, I'm not. I'm in Alaska at the moment. I have a place in Alaska and a place in Hawaii, and I kind of go back and forth between them.
So as cold as it can get and as warm as it can get, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I've had several Hawaiian winters. Now I'm here for an Alaskan one. So
you had what?
I said I've had several Hawaiian winters, and now I'm here for an Alaskan one.
Wow. Okay, well, good luck to you. Just stay indoors. Stay warm.
Oh, it's just getting it.
What is the UAP Medical Coalition?
Okay, so most of the work I've done has involved engineers and scientists, and it's been about what we call nuts and bolts research. It's about hard science, hard data, hard information, things that a physicist can work with. And but the literature is rife with these stories of exposures to UAP leading to mental health issues and in some case physical problems. And so I got involved with all of this because I've seen UFOs and way before I ever got involved with research. It's one of the drivers for me. And it definitely was psychologically challenging to deal with. It cost me friends, cost me family, it cost me jobs. It cost me a lot of things to do what I do. Hmm. And so I thought we should take a look at this part of it, because when we get done with understanding what they are and how they do what they do, we're going to want to know why. And when we look at the history of all this, it isn't going to feel good. You know, there's a lot of the stories involved with this are not nice stories. So what I wanted to do was to make sure mental health and medical professionals were up to speed on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to encourage them to do research, provide resources, and then beyond that, help with policy issues, because we have first responders and law enforcement that overlap with mental health and medical. And so when we have a case where an incident occurs, what do the police need to know? What do they need to know tactically? What do they need to know in terms of containment and how to manage it? And then what did mental health and medical people need to know in order to treat people that have had these exposures, or even law enforcement that's had these exposures?
So mm-hmm.
That's really kind of the purpose of UAP Med, is to start aligning society so that it can cope with the reality of UAP as described.
You think that's what they're doing now, is kind of spoon feeding us information and facts?
Well, it's working out that way. I'd like to think there's a plan behind it. A lot of this is very irresponsible otherwise. The public commentary is such that it can trigger vulnerable people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I mentioned this on the show before, that the fact that David Grush,
yes,
came before the the hearing at the congressional hearing. Okay, I got those words. Anyway. And I told him what he knew. Told him we had crash disks and alien bodies. There was still some people within that Congress that denied that what he said under oath. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the proof will come out with the interview with the IG.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are ways to validate what the guy said. That's what the hearing was for.
Oh, yeah.
That's what that committee is there for, is to get to the bottom of that. He made his claims and the statements. They weren't just his own. There are some 40 others that he works with that have also spoken to the Inspector General of the intelligence community. And so it was really a matter of getting a skiff and clearance to be able to talk about it. And right. I think that's happening now. And we'll find out what the Inspector General tells the Oversight Committee. I my concern really is more about the information itself. It's toxic. You know, UAP info, I mean, we all have a right to know, but some of us can't process it. We can't understand what it means.
Right.
And the implications for some of us, depending on our belief systems and how we're aligned with the world, it could be extremely challenging. So the whole point is to develop support to get mental health people engaged in thinking about this, understand that these things happen, and not to, and because much like a rape victim, a victim of a UAP assault is, they're vulnerable. You know, and they want to know that the people that they're talking to believe them.
Right.
In order to get the support or the help they need. And so what we want to do is kind of suspend the disbelief and get research going, encourage them to use their skill sets in order to understand what's going on and how better to take care of patients.
Right. I need to take 1 minute to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, your host, and we are speaking with Mr. Ted Rowe. He's the co-founder and executive director of NARCAP and UAP researcher. I got to watch myself there. UFOs. But you have mentioned in an email that you were involved with UAP research because you have direct UAP exposures, though you weren't able to discuss these facts for decades. Can you share that with our listeners today?
Well, sure. A little bit. As I mentioned earlier, I've been involved with nuts and bolts research on UAP, which involves physicists and hard science. And because of that, we tend to stay away from difficult conversations like occupant cases and things like that. So I haven't been able to talk about any of these things, mainly to protect the image of my teams. And now that the environment's changed a little bit, I can share a little bit myself, and that is that I've had lifelong exposures to UAP, starting when I was 5 years old. They drive me to try to find answers in all of this and to understand it and to be in service to others who are exposed to it. So I'm very careful with all of that. I've seen more than a lot of people have. And, in the end, it's really about taking care of the people around me.
So what do you recall from 5 years old?
Well, the first one involved a disc flying in front of our car when I was a kid. I was riding with the grandparents and my mother and my aunt and my brother, and a disc was pacing the car, and then it came around to the front of the car and stayed in front of us for a little bit. My grandfather slowed the vehicle down to almost a stop, and then it went over the embankment and down the side of the slope. He thought it landed. That's the first one I really remember. I think there was probably one before that. But they happened off and on throughout my life. I've gone as long as 17, 18 years without an exposure, and then I'll have a cluster of them. This kind of thing. So the one that got me involved here in the UAP field, the one that kind of pushed me into it was happened in Oakland, California. and it was pretty blatant, and took a lot of time to deal with it. It was very destabilizing for my life all the way around, and for anybody that was associated with me. And so I draw from those experiences with as I move forward with UAP Medical Coalition and the other work I'm doing.
You say it's been traumatic for you and your family, and for what reason? Because
it's one thing to kind of remember seeing something when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And you have all this distance, you know. I'm 60 something years old now, so you have all this distance. But then it's quite something else as an adult to have it right in front of you, and see it and have to deal with the implications. It was fear. A lot of it was fear, ontological shock, I guess you could say. Just pretty much a destruction of any idea of safety or social structure or, you know, just about everything that holds a person together, you know, is affected by this. And if you're a thinker, or if you're somebody like me that's a bit obsessive compulsive, that has maybe you've got CPTSD from a rough childhood, this kind of thing, you can fixate on it. And I did. Within 6 months, I reported the incident in Oakland to the PR office at Ames Research Center. And within hours, Dr. Richard Haynes showed up at the slip where I was living on a sailboat with a friend, interviewed all three of us that were involved with that exposure. And within, I don't know, 3-4 months of that, I was helping him set up NARCAP and running that as his XO.
So was this a UFO sighting, an abduction? What?
Kind of all of the above. We were driving southbound on 880 in Oakland, and we saw something out over the city of Oakland that was very low. And I sort of felt it before I saw it, and I kind of leaned around. Susan was driving, and I leaned around, and I said, "Now that's unusual." And as we were looking at it, it turned. It was a yellow light over a white light, and then it turned and became a rectangle, a yellow rectangle with two white lights underneath it. And as we were heading, we were going down a long curve, a couple miles of curve, and it came down Highway 24 and intercepted us. It came to a stop about a mile away, and as the car came around and we were facing it, as I was looking at it, the thing just kind of jumped and came to a dead stop right in front of our car that matched our speed down the road, less than its own length from the windshield. We picked up in the next minute or so, we picked up 3 hours and 18 minutes or something like that. And it happened while we were driving. There's no off ramp on that stretch. So
what do you mean you picked up 3 hours?
The clock advanced 3 hours and 18
minutes. Oh, missing time.
70 seconds. Yeah.
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 3 hours.
Not missing in the sense of, I don't know what just happened, but more like we picked up 3 hours. How the hell did that happen? You know?
Yeah.
And it was very disturbing. The whole thing was really uncomfortable and stayed that way for months afterwards. And basically up to not long ago, I finally found some coping mechanisms that helped, and getting UAP Med going has been helpful. I have mental health and medical people on staff. I've got about a staff of almost 30 helping us run UAP Med. So there's a lot of support there, and the kind of work we're doing, I see, helps others, and that helps me.
Do you consciously remember anything that happened aboard the ship?
No, I don't recall us actually ever being aboard. In fact, in my estimation of the situation, there's a boundary area around these devices. And when you get close to them, you come under their influence. And so I think that they operate out of a sort of a separate time perspective. They're in a separate frame from our reality.
Different time zone. Yeah.
Right. Right. So when you get up close to it, then you become part of their time zone.
Right.
Time moves differently in that space. So you pick up three hours and in very little linear time, local time, you know. And that's just my guess. I don't recall anything actually happening. The thing was big enough that there was room in there for a car, no question.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have to agree with you on that analogy or, you know, prospect that, you know, you're in a different time zone. You're in their time zone. And I think that's the only way they can navigate going from standstill. The thousands of miles an hour would crush it would crush the entire craft.
Yeah.
But it's not really going that fast, I don't think.
Not for them.
Going in their time span.
Right. When I watched this thing move, it jumped, and it was almost a mile exactly. I plotted it out on Google Maps. Mm-hmm. It was almost a mile exactly. And when it jumped and came to a dead stop, it did it so quick that if I'd have blinked my eye, I wouldn't have seen it. Mm-hmm. And as it was moving so fast that I couldn't acquire information quick enough. It would stop and start. So it kind of stuttered through my vision. Mm-hmm. Because my eyes just couldn't capture it moving that quickly.
Right.
And it didn't seem to have any adverse effect, that movement.
On the ship or on the craft?
Yeah. Yeah. It just went thwack and came to a stop. It was transparent on one side. You could see the full internal, that you couldn't see through it, but you could see into it. And there was a crew, and you could see them. There was three of them, and they weren't people. They weren't human beings. Let's put it that way. And
humanoid, though.
Yeah, human-like. The arms, legs, head. You know. Uh-huh. But they didn't rock on their heels, and they were standing up. So the internal inertia in there was negligible. You know, there was no. It frankly, it should have reduced them to goo. The start should have killed them. Never mind the stop.
Right. You know?
So there
would be some kind of inertia cancellation technology going on there. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. It's probably one of two things. It's they either can organize quanta around them like quarks, like a quark field, that can absorb inertia for them in this environment, or they're decoupled from the local environment.
Mm-hmm.
One or the other is my guess.
Right.
It's between you, me, and whoever's listening, you know. No.
Who knows, huh?
Yeah. Somebody knows.
Somebody knows. Was that your only encounter like that?
No. No, I've had them in both in the context of I guess he'd call him an experiencer, and then in the context of a researcher, I've been in places, hotspots, they call them, where UAP occur, and I've been there when they've occurred, and had a pretty much of a bird's eye seat of it.
Tell us what that hotspot is.
Well,
let's send all our listeners out to this hotspot.
Well, that's the first thing I wouldn't do. If you're thinking about going out to these places and you think that there's a non-human intelligence involved, think twice about what you're doing, why you're doing it, and where your audacity comes from. We have a whole planet full of people here, you know, and you some things affect others, and we need to be respectful of that.
Mm-hmm.
First off. With that caveat, you know, as far as hotspots go, there are places where UAP do come and go. And if you're there at the right time, you'll see it happen.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. I've been told in Hawaii by one of the priestesses there, Aka, friend of mine, that UFOs frequented a particular bay there on the Big Island. And, then one day, about a year after she told me that, I was sitting there one late evening. It was about 2 in the morning, and it happened exactly the way she described it. And basically a flying saucer came out of the water and flew over my head and went up the ravine, which is pretty much what she described happened there. And she'd been living there all her life. And her mother kept that place before her. They keep the temples, the great temples around the islands, the women do. And usually it's a lineage, a family that does this. Mm-hmm. And Aka was the latest, and then it was her mother before that, and her mother's mother before that, going back to 1819.
Mm-hmm. So in Hawaii, they're pretty much acquainted with the UAP phenomenon, eh?
Yeah. Interesting. I've spoken with Kumu, which are the priests, and they say it's fairly new, that UFOs started showing up about the time that white people started showing up.
Wow.
In about 1800.
Yeah.
And I had a similar conversation with some Australian people who, you know, keep in mind, these are cultures with oral traditions. They don't have written languages, but they memorize everything. And the memories are quite extensive and quite detailed. Mm. So everything's got a name. Every place has a name. In the Australian perspective, it's part of their magic to know names, certain types of names. Yeah. A place could have five different names, but only a clever man would know the fifth name, you know, where the magic is done. This kind of thing. And I talked to them, and they don't have a name for UFOs.
Hmm.
Okay, there's a 55,000-year-old culture there with a rich oral tradition, thousands of years old, and they don't have a name for UFOs. And they're as boggled by them as we are.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really point at an old phenomenon. It could be 500 years old or 1,000 or something, but new from their perspective.
So maybe Captain Cook brought the going with him, huh?
Yeah, who knows, you know, he was there at Cape Tribulation, no doubt about it. So, but yeah, it's interesting that the Hawaiians kind of compared it with the Western expansion. I don't really know. There might be a deeper root to that isn't really true to the facts as far as the phenomenon goes.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting to hear them say it.
Right. You had briefed the U.S. Congress on the UAP matter in 2003 and 2005. Do you feel they took you seriously back then?
I remember. This was for a it was an inquiry on UAP in about 2003, 2004. It was part of an initiative led by the Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah.
And we asked some questions of the some Air Force generals about a scramble over Washington, D.C., and then followed up on that further, asking them about, you know, the types of incursions that were taking place across U.S. air defense zones and how often it was happening. And at the time they said it wasn't happening very often. I have a hunch they knew better. but the shift in temperature from then till now is discernible. The fact that I was able to kind of move up into a mainstream program with AIAA from NARCAP, which was a grassroots data collection and advocacy program. I mean, that shows you there's change. I wouldn't be involved with these teams working with the kinds of people that I'm working with, who I don't have the credentials they do, but I have the core knowledge they don't. So I'm part of the formative moment, you know.
You say they claim that it doesn't happen that often, but all it takes is one incident to prove they're real.
Well, and we're pretty much behind the scenes. Everyone's satisfied that something's happening, and they're definitely have moved beyond the idea of whether or not UAP or UFOs are real. there's a lot of arguments about what they are, but it's not disputed anymore. And we turned a corner in 2021, and it's just taken time for the system to admit it, you know, to adapt to it.
Well, as the congressman so intelligently put, they exist, they're not ours. They're either Chinese, Russian, or other. What? What's other? Tell us, what's other? And then he walks away. So, anyway.
Well, yeah. And this whistling past the graveyard has got to stop.
Yeah.
At some point, they're going to have to take this on for what it is. We need a better name for them than unidentified anomalous phenomena. Mm. We need to call these things whatever the heck they are. Mm. And whatever it is that is known about them that can be divulged, it should be. I don't think that everybody needs to know, per se. I think we need our culture, our global society needs to be able to continue without being influenced from outside. You know, everything that we've achieved has been at the cost of rivers of blood in our history. We don't owe anybody any apologies for how we got here. And our future is ours if we respect our past, what it took to get here, to become what we are. And we shouldn't be tolerating anything that doesn't respect boundaries. You know, whether it's security boundaries, whether it's physical boundaries or psychological boundaries, I don't see any respect at all from the architects of these incidents. And they don't communicate. They don't talk. In that sense, there's really, it's on us to have our reaction to them, not to try and project on them, oh, they must be this or they must be that, or it's a misunderstanding or whatever. No. We react based on what we tolerate. We don't tolerate having our children taken in the night and indoctrinated, then we don't tolerate it. And it doesn't matter who does it. We don't give them an excuse for it. We say no. And then we let the situation develop from there. And that's my concern, is that we have to say no at some point and draw a line and say this doesn't continue. The relationship has to evolve, or, you know.
Well, I think that's good advice, whether we're talking to extraterrestrials, other dimensionals, or other countries. What do you think?
I think so. If you, nobody knows what you stand for if you don't stand for something, mm-hmm. You know.
That's
and,
it.
You know, you got to draw a line and say, no, this is not okay. It's not okay to take our people in the night. It's not okay to take fetuses. It's not okay to do what you do. And if you keep it up, you're going to wish you hadn't. We're going to resist you. Yeah. You know, and on the flip side, maybe you can explain it to us in a way that makes it palatable.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You know, anyway, go ahead, David.
I was just going to say I need to take one more break to remind my listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell, your host of We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with UAP researcher and co-founder of NARCAP, Mr. Ted Rowe. You have been, have there been, I should say, incidents of plane crashes, injuries, illnesses, or deaths where UAP appeared to be the culprit?
Well, from the aviation side, there's anecdotal evidence. Keep in mind that the NTSB wasn't established until the 1960s. So in terms of collecting that kind of data prior to that, there isn't a lot. Mm-hmm. But as far as physiological injuries go, yes. In the overall literature, yes. I've had a case come to me recently that involved researchers who were assaulted by UAP. Managed to get it on video, got it on infrared video.
These are pilots?
No, these were ground observers.
Wow.
But we do have pilot cases where we're suspicious about it, but again, you know, if nobody asks the question, if even the FAA won't allow a UFO report, then how do you come to the conclusion that a UFO caused a crash? So that's been the real problem, is getting data collected and expanding the system enough to where it will include UAP related incidents and consider them. Like some of our papers at NARCAP are in the Department of Transportation's library for aviation accidents and investigations. So we're kind of listed as one of the catch-all kind of other bins that investigators ought to consider. But nobody's going to risk their reputation even as a minority report and suggest that a UFO contributed to the crash, unless that there was no way to escape that argument. That's why we're concerned about things like incursions into restricted airspace, like around airports, like the O'Hare case, where you have something hovering less than 1,000 feet. Nobody knows what direction it can go in. They can be quite dynamic and move quite quickly, unpredictably. Mm-hmm. And then you have aircraft in most vulnerable phases of flight, landing or takeoff. Mm-hmm. It's a recipe for disaster. And that's one kind of problem we look at with these things. We have electromagnetic effects, which is another kind of problem we're concerned about, particularly when aircraft are operating on micro voltages. Do commercial aircraft need to be shielded? For example, all of the cases, I've got 57 of them that involve electromagnetic effects on aircraft, and all of them involve balls of light. So are there more cases that we don't know about, you know, and what do we do to mitigate the ball of light problem, you know, for pilots? Do we tell them that there are balls of light out there? They should kind of, you know, do whatever it takes to get away from them and then report the deviation when they get in, when they land.
You think those balls of light are plasma?
I think plasma is involved. It kind of depends on how they make the plasma, which is the concern for its effect on the operating systems of aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
If they're using RF energy versus maybe a magnetic field or something else, you know, that could change the way we look at that warning and what we do to mitigate it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, plasmas are involved with that. I think it was Dr. Teodorani that started pushing the idea that the color of these balls of light might represent atmospheric constituents and that they're emanating and causing ionization. Blue would be nitrogen, you know, orange might be hydrogen. Pinkish could be helium, that kind of thing.
Well, is that suggesting they're natural? We just don't understand.
No. In fact, it kind of pushes in the other direction, because it takes a good deal of energy to ionize, you know, the surface area of a 30-foot disc,
right,
you know, top to bottom, or a 2 or 3 meter diameter sphere or whatever. That's a lot of electricity. Mm-hmm. To make that happen, to create that ionization. Mm-hmm. And it really begs for another argument, because naturally that wouldn't be able to maintain. Natural plasmas like ball lightning are 5 to 7 seconds duration.
Right.
They don't last long at all. These things go hours, you know.
Right.
So
due to the erratic yet disciplined maneuvers of some of these UAP, they would appear to be intelligently controlled. So what would be your best guess as to the intelligence behind it?
Well, if you do a little bit of deductive work, say go back and look at these cases, the anecdote cases that go back to 1916 for pilots, and look at the trends in the data, and you'll see disks, spheres, cylinders, balls of light primarily are reported. And that maintains right up to the present day. So amongst the spheres, you have the metallic spheres, right, along with the ball of light spheres. So we know that that particular phenomenon, the metallic spheres, have been flying long, the entire time we've had airplanes, which predates the People's Republic of China, which was founded in 1948. Mm-hmm. It basically, 1916, it predates the Bolshevik Revolution and the Russians.
Right.
We were just getting telephones and electric lights and cars in motion in 1916, airplanes, just kind of starting out with those. So who can fly an enclosed metallic sphere globally and in a manner that's quite dynamic? And it speeds up to multiple Mach, you know, multiple speed of sound.
Right. From a standing position.
Right, right. And bring it to a stop, you know, the same way.
Yeah.
You know, deductive logic kind of moves you towards, you know, probably not us, you know.
now we're back to the other.
Yeah.
What's other?
I wouldn't say that any of it's derived from a human technological arc.
Right.
And that comes both as someone with experience as well as somebody who's been working in the field.
Yeah.
And I carry a bit of bias, but others would just call it experience, and I'm a little further down the rabbit hole than some in this regard.
I like to ask my guests if they feel it's extraterrestrial, other dimensional, or a little bit of both.
Well,
yes.
If you look at the physics involved, okay, they don't have aerodynamic lifting bodies. They don't use propulsive thrust. Okay, mm-hmm. So there's no exit ports or any of this kind of thing. And it looks like inertia isn't really an issue for them. They don't suffer for changing in velocity or heading.
Right.
So my guess is that velocity equals D over T doesn't really apply here. We're not looking at spaceships, in other words. We're not looking at generational craft that are traversing the vastness of space to be here. They are coming here very quickly from wherever the hell it is they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're looking at general relativistic principles in terms of movement. But I haven't seen anything that tells me they come from outside of our realm, outside of our universe.
You mean outside of our dimension?
Yeah, outside of the universe as we understand it, okay? I think they come from another planet where they figured things out, or they were cross-pollinated with somebody who had figured it out, and that our understandings of the universe and its origins aren't quite complete. Avi Loeb wrote a paper a while back about habitability of the universe in its earliest epoch, and suggested that the ambient temperature of the universe was about 73 degrees within a couple hundred thousand years of the Big Bang, meaning that life was possible pretty much everywhere. And now it's become more localized because of the expansion, the universe is cooling down. So life is occurring where there's heat and where there's silicates and rocks, minerals, ices to make things happen. So planetary systems, galactic systems, this kind of thing.
So I take it you're a fan of bending space-time continuum to get from point A to point B?
Unconventional transits, via general relativistic principles, I think are probably at the root of this. Looking for gravitational anomalies would be really important. If we could detect them real time and quickly, it would validate fairly soon what I'm suspecting is at the root of this. I know I'm not alone in this suspicion. So
you say that they witnessed a lot of UAPs coming out of the water in Hawaii. Well, I think they've witnessed a lot of UAPs coming out of the water all over the world, actually.
Yeah.
But do you feel they have bases down there underwater?
It would seem like they have facilities wherever they are. They could have phased matter that just isn't visible to us.
Phased matter.
Yeah, and just have cities, you know, that we don't see that are rich. Share space with us. I don't know. I don't have the answers on that, but it seems to me that, that it would behoove them to have facilities on this end.
Oh, yeah. But what you're saying, the space matter existing parallel to physical matter, isn't that other dimensional?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. It's just a different state of matter. But it isn't outside, it isn't decoupled from local space time. It's just overlaid on it. Mm-hmm. And it's not something I understand really, really well. It's just an idea that when we look at these things and, particularly hotspots where it looks like there's a lot of activity, and like there's secondary stuff when you look at them, there's flashes and other kinds of things that aren't UAP themselves, but are light phenomena, discharges and this kind of thing. It makes you wonder if there's a facility there that you just can't see.
Yeah, really. You mentioned that you wanted to speak more on the UAP Medical Coalition.
Sure.
I think you mentioned it.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there anything specific?
Well, we're about 16 months in working on our program. We've been doing legislative outreach and other types of outreach, and also doing development with law enforcement and first responders, working on policy issues and identifying key stakeholders to move further with that. But our primary focus is in helping people that have had experiences and haven't been able to adapt well to it. Informing mental health and medical professionals about the phenomenon, getting them to talk about it, getting them to work on it inside their own professional societies, and then being supportive to patients. I think it's really important. It's a heavy load. I've carried it myself, so I know personally what that's like. And I've met people steadily and more every day that have had the same kinds of problems. So we're here to try and help with that and trying to move that process forward.
Do you feel you have PTSD as a result?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
How are you dealing with that?
Well, there's a couple of approaches to PTSD. A lot of it has to do with mindfulness and knowing when you're triggered. Being able to recognize that triggering and then walk yourself through whatever steps you need to get right with yourself again in the process. It never ever goes away. But you can notice when you're stressing, when your nerves are up. There are times when I can't go outside. I can't go outside and look up. It's just too destructive. If I look up and I see something there, it derails my life for years. I've had to stop having relationships, because it's not fair to the person sitting next to me to have to go through this in order to be around me. I watched a girlfriend of mine the relationship just went bad after an exposure that was unambiguous. I know I can't be the only one by any stretch that's dealing with this.
Oh, I'm sure.
And the guess is that there are many more than we suspect. So trying to help with ontological shock, trying to cope with that is at the root of it. There's hypervigilance. You know, you're nervous all the time. You're looking up all the time. You're fixated on the subject all the time because you know it's real. And you know people don't believe you. So there's a lot of damage that's this stuff does to otherwise good people that really didn't need to have that thrown into their lives or imposed on them, you know.
But do you feel that I understand the mental torment and what have you, but do you feel that these beings really, mean us harm or plan on doing us harm in the future? Don't you think they would have done so already?
I think they're efficient enough that they don't need to do war. Social engineering for them works on a whole different level, and they can get what they want out of our society and out of our situation without destroying us. But that doesn't mean it's a good outcome for us. they can come on and tell us they're great and we're wonderful and, hey, welcome to the galactic community and whatever they want. But in the end, the primary motivation for almost anything in the universe is abiding self-interest. They didn't come here for us, you know.
What happened, I can get personal, what happened to you that makes you feel that way about it?
Well, when I had the incident in Oakland as an adult, keeping in mind I had a number of experiences under my belt prior to that, I found myself going in some really weird mental state where I thought I was interesting. I thought I was special. I thought, oh, gee, I have the attention of these things that nobody can even agree exist, and here I am, and, you know, they're showing up in front of me and blah, blah, blah. And for a while that was kind of, and then I got to thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, when in my life have I ever been special, you know, in any kind of like egotistical way, when, you know, versus just, you know, being, you know, my mom loved me. Okay. Which is great. Right. But, you know, in terms of being the chosen one or whatever, no. And that's not what was happening here. I wasn't the chosen one. I was, they pulled the drawer open and I was the first rat they reached for. I was the one that was available. And they don't respect boundaries. You can't tell them no. They won't explain themselves. Right. And all of that together adds up to, you know, I'd rather not, you know, this doesn't look like a good situation, you know, If you'd like us to believe otherwise, you need to do things differently.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go taking people in the middle of the night. You know, don't be talking to people in their heads.
Right.
All the other stuff that goes along with that. And so there's no respect for boundaries.
Yeah.
And all living creatures have boundaries. All creatures I've ever dealt with have boundaries. I've been stung, bit, stepped on, otherwise reacted to by just about every creature I've ever encountered. And it's because they've got a boundary. They got a limit. We've got one and it's not respected.
Yeah. Ted, where can our listeners go to find out more about, NARCAP and your work?
Sure. NARCAP can be, viewed at NARCAP.org. The website's there. We have about 50 papers on UAP and aviation issues. Mm-hmm. And then there's UAP Medical Coalition, which is UAPmed.org. And that's where we're dealing with the mental health and medical issues related to UAP exposures and informing mental health and medical professionals about them. And then there's AIAAUAP.org, which is the program at the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And our website's rolling out sometime in the next few days.
Very good. Mr. Ted Rowe, I appreciate you coming on, and I'm sure you have a lot more information that you'd like to share. And so maybe we can do this again sometime, man.
Be happy to, David. Very nice to meet you and your viewers.
Good meeting you, and thank you for coming on, okay?
My pleasure.
Have a good one.
You too.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Thank you.